Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we have Yasmin Khan talking about the Raj at War.
Thank you very much, Jeremy, for that kind introduction and to the Southern Spinal Injuries Trust for sponsoring this event. Well, it's a great pleasure to be here and to see you all. And as Jeremy said, I'm going to talk today about Britain's Empire's part in Second World War, particularly India. And this is a part of British Second World War history that is still coming to fruition, I would argue. It's still a really exciting place for historians to work because there's still untold stories. There's still lots of things we don't actually know about the Empire's role in the Second World War. If anything, the Empire is, in a way, the elephant in the room. There are still archives being found. There are still stories being told about particularly people's experience on the ground, ordinary people's non-combatant experiences on the home fronts of empire. And in a way, in my book, The Raj at War, what I was trying to do was not tell necessarily a tactical or a battle story of what happened to India during the Second World War, but think about the experiences of Indians who went through that war. So not just the soldiers, although I'll talk a bit about soldiers today, but also the wives of soldiers, the children of soldiers, the people who are growing the food that's feeding the armies, and all the other infrastructure that helped support India's role in the Second World War. So if we know more and more about what happened in Stalingrad or in the Blitz, it's that sort of texture of everyday life, I suppose, that we're trying to get to now in the empire, what was happening for people on the ground in the empire. And similarly, historians working in Algeria and in China and in Africa doing similar things. Because 2.5 million soldiers from the Indian subcontinent were involved in the Indian Army, were in the Indian Army during the Second World War. Half 0.5 million from Africa. There were, in total, 5 million soldiers from the Empire Commonwealth involved in the Second World War. And India had a sort of double role, in a way. On the one hand, it was the site of battle, just, you know, on those fringes, on the borders with Burma. There were actual battles within Indian territory, in Kohima and Imphal. But it wasn't actually invaded, ultimately. India wasn't invaded. But it was also a sort of expansive home front. So it was a barrack. There were soldiers from all over the world coming through India. We forget that there were 200,000 Americans in India, in Calcutta in particular, including black American soldiers. There were soldiers from Australia, there were nurses from Canada, all coming through India, sort of stationed there. There were refugees coming to India. There were Polish refugees. Unbelievable forgotten story of 10,000 Poles who came to India, who'd escaped from the Poland, had gone through Central Asia, and eventually were given refuge in India. Burmese fleeing from Southeast Asia, and people fleeing from Southeast Asia when the Japanese swept into that part of the empire. So India was a training ground. There were soldiers training everywhere in India. There was munitions plants. Indian factories were making uniforms for the armies across the eastern part of the empire. They were making parachutes. And it was also a site of rest and rehabilitation, because once it became clear that India wasn't going to be invaded, it was also a space where soldiers who were fighting in Burma would come back and have a bit of downtime. And so you have amazing tourist photography of soldiers who had a few months rest and would go to Kashmir or go to see the Taj Mahal. And it was a site of propaganda. So the imperial state, as in Britain, the state had to do things in India. It had to change because of the war. It had to deliver propaganda. It had to organize information. It had to assess internal security and police dissent. It had to reorient the economies around the war economy, recruit, secure the borders, oversee food distribution, and prepare potentially for aerial attack. And another thing, some wonderful photographs, I'll show you some of them, of air raid precaution wardens, Indian air raid precaution wardens. And in fact, these women on the front cover of my book are British Asian women, air raid precaution workers. And you can see, it's a bit dark, but you can probably just about see their uniforms. And they were working as air raid precaution wardens. And I was very lucky, I was very pleased to win that one with the publisher, because initially they wanted a kind of fighter plane on the front cover. and I said, well, actually, quite a lot of the books about women and non-combatants, and not about soldiers. And so we decided on this, and I'm really pleased with that image, because I think it sums up what the book's trying to be about, trying to say, actually, there were experiences beyond that of the soldier. So all of this brought big transformation to India in the 1940s, and it had a transformative effect on what happened afterwards. And by 1947, when partition happens and that dreadful refugee movement and all the things that happened in 1947, a lot of that kind of became a consequence of the transformations that had happened in the 1940s. But I can't cover all of this today, and I'm not even going to try. I'll just talk a bit about some of the key things that I think are interesting. But as I said, historians are only just getting to grips with it, I think, and it's an epic story. And it matters. It matters in Britain today because we have lots of South Asian people who draw their ancestry back to India, and a lot of them don't even recognise that the Second World War is part of their own history. There were, for instance, men who were evacuated at Dunkirk, who came from regions that are today in Pakistan. And there's a very good student actually at Exeter University who's writing a whole thesis, a whole dissertation about this little group of soldiers who were evacuated at Dunkirk. So it's about sort of sometimes connecting up South Asian history and British history, particularly for British Asians, but also for everybody, because I think I come across so many people who say, well, my father or my grandfather was in India during the war, or in Southeast Asia during the war. Because of conscription, it was a time when more British people went out to the East than at any other time before. Before that, you'd had to, you know, if you wanted to work in the civil service or work in the empire, you did. But these were men who didn't have a choice. You know, they were going out to the empire because of conscription. So there's so many links, actually hidden links in a way that we don't remember always, between British people and that experience of India's Second World War. And the pressures that were put on people. There were major pressures put on people during that time. And I will talk about some of those things. And the similarities in terms of that gravity of experience that people experienced in Britain, of loss, of missing young men, of food shortages and actual starvation in India's case. And it is a divided story. And I will come to that towards the end, because we've also had very different memories in Britain and in India of what happened during the Second World War, because there were nationalists and breakaway forces who supported the Japanese and were pro-fascist in India. Bose's INA, the Indian National Army. And what I'm trying to do, I suppose, and I will talk more about this, is bring together those two stories and not say that they're separate, actually, that some people... It was a very confusing time, and a lot of people were caught up in the turmoil of war. And the histories have tended to be, on the one hand, to tell a story of Burma and of Indian soldiers, and on the other hand, to tell the story of the INA, of the Indian National Army, and of Bose, and of anti-British nationalism. And textbooks in India have tended to go down that route. But actually, there's a lot more fuzziness in the middle. There's a lot more grey zone in the middle. I'm sure with an audience like you, some of this I don't need to recap or go back over, but I will just to refresh memories, how close the Japanese got to invasion. By 1942, all of Burma was falling to the Japanese. There was the flight of Indians and Anglo-Burmese and British civilians from Burma. And there was a moment when bombs did fall, not many, but they did fall on this isn't marked up, but Madras, also on Vizag, which is a port city just north of that region. And Calcutta also had a couple of bombs. There was also a moment when the, a warning went out that Madras was going to be invaded, was going to fall, which was wrong, but it led to the flight of about half the population of that city inland. And just to go through some key dates, I mean, 1939, India entered the war. It was entered by London. London decided that the empire was in the war with India, with Britain. There was no two ways about it. 1942, the fall of Burma, Singapore, India threatened. In 1942, similarly, and not disconnected in any way at all, you also get an uprising within India, the Quit India movement, and a kind of rebellion. And people, some of the soldiers who were captured in Southeast Asia joined the Indian National Army. In 1943, there's the Bengal famine. I'll return to that. And by 1944, the tide is turning. In Field Marshal Slim's famous words, defeat turns into victory, and you have the recapture, the pushing out of Japanese, and the end of the war. The Congress Party, Nehru's party, Gandhi's party, was imprisoned in 1942 because of that rebellion, because of that Quit India rebellion. And so those leaders are imprisoned all the way until 1945. Gandhi comes out a bit earlier because he hasn't been very well, but basically they will come out in 1940, they will come out in 1945. And then in 1947, partition and independence happens. So as I said, I'm not going to try and cover all of this. It's too much, it's too hot. I will talk about soldiers in particular, and the research that I've done into soldiers and into recruitment. And then I'll think about women after that, so a little bit about women and women's experiences. But one of the things that does distinguish India is that it was a volunteer army. The Indian army was a volunteer army. It wasn't conscripted. And so a big question is, why did all these soldiers sign up? Why were these young men going off to the war, if they didn't know much about the fascists, if they weren't educated about the war? What was it that was making young men like these go and line up when the recruitment officer came along? And the lack of knowledge about what was going on is quite striking. I mean, one elderly gentleman who now lives near Oldham, Ali Akbar, said, "I went with happiness. My whole family for generations had been in the army, and it was my dream to do army service. But when I enlisted, that's when I found out the war had started." So, you can't underestimate the lack of literacy of some of these young men. A lot of men talked about actually the army being an attraction because you could learn to read and write in the Indian Army. So actually the attractions of literacy. And men like Ali Akbar came from regions where for a long time the British had recruited historically, the so-called martial races. There were parts of India, particularly Punjab, in the north, where there had been a tradition of recruiting. And at the start of the war, over 60% of the Indian Army was Punjabi. It was dominated by these so-called martial races. Men from from areas that are now to part of North India and Pakistan and Punjab and the northeast and northwest. The army wasn't that large at that point. I mean, it grew 10 times during the war. So there was this big push to recruit and to find new men and new sources of men. By late 1940, 20,000 a month were joining. And they were coming from particularly from those northern regions, but the reach of recruitment kind of spread, and new sorts of young men started to come from other regions where their families hadn't had such a tradition of being in the war. Because, of course, the Indian Army had been in the First World War. So in some villages, people would have known veterans from the First World War. They would have known something about soldiering from that. The First World War soldiers had been in Gallipoli, in Egypt, in Sudan, in Aden, and Persia. And this was already an army which was used to being abroad. I mean, just to give you an example, in September 1940, the 6th Rajputana Rifles, The 1st and the 4th battalions were already in North Africa. The 2nd and 3rd were in the Northwest Frontier province, so sort of battling on the borders of the Northwest Frontier province. The 5th battalion was in Hong Kong, and the 6th battalion was still being formed in North India. So these were men who were being used and had been used all over the empire already. They were already used to those who were in the army to being spread around. But they're voluntary and they're not conscripted. So why do they join up? And sometimes it's about getting a well-paid government job or a state job. Now, this was a well-paid job by Indian standards. Even a regular soldier had a guaranteed pay. And one of the things that's really notable in India is the wages for soldiers just really kept ahead of inflation. They really, every time there was even a stirring of trouble, the wages kept going up of the Indian soldier. There was regular feeding. This was bread or rice, daily feeding. It was a big incentive for people to join. But there was also pride and a sense of honour and duty, particularly for those families that had a tradition of serving the Raj. And for more middle-class individuals, the war started to expand sort of technical training and chances for people like dentists. I interviewed somebody who'd been one of the very first dentists in the Indian Army, psychiatry. So some of those sorts of bits of the military that hadn't existed before in the Indian Army were starting to grow, modernise. And for officers, there's a big opportunity for the Indianisation of the officer corps. So across the war, at the start, only about 1 in 10 of the officers were Indian. By the end, it's 4 to 1. But there's a kind of underlying some of this. There's also assumptions about who the martial races are. The recruiters would go out with handbooks. They had these wonderful things called recruitment handbooks, and they would describe what sort of young men to look for. Who were the sort of people you wanted in your forces? So one, for instance, says, the Rajputana Jats are on the whole, a fine lot physically. They have fine thighs, and they're orderly. So there's these kind of ideas about who the stature, the height, and the typology of these different types of men who might be able to serve the Raj. And some of them were definitely teenagers. I know that's not just the case in India, but there were a lot of 14-year-olds joining up. No birth certificates, often faked birth certificates or no birth certificates, so it's just assurances about age. Runaways going against their parents' wishes. And women could be quite resistant to their sons joining the Indian Army in the war. And there was even a medal awarded from 1943. Women who had 2 or more sons serving in the Indian Army would get a medal. Could get a medal. If they had a husband and 2 sons serving, they'd get a medal, or if they had 3 sons. And I think that gives a sense of the need to kind of encourage families to support this effort. There's plenty of evidence of those who went when their parents weren't looking, pretty much ran away. Mangal Singh, who James Holland, who's, as you all know, behind this festival in many ways, shared an interview with me with Mangal Singh, who went to see his recruiting officer, the local recruiting officer, when his parents away from his village in Punjab. The very same day, he passed a cursory medical inspection, signed an enrolment certificate, was issued kit, railway pass, advance on his wages, small bonus, and told to go to the signal training centre, which is about 300 miles away. And he didn't see his parents for two more years after that, just went. So there's a lot of different stories, and it's not as if there's one reason why these men joined up, but there's an element of adventurism and excitement about going for some of them. But it's not just necessarily an ideological commitment to fighting the war, because at that point, particularly in 1940, it's a very long way away, and people don't necessarily know what it's about, if they know much about it at all. This is what a young man getting a Victoria Cross from Auchinleck, the commander-in-chief of the Indian Army. And those of you who've been there will recognise just the architecture behind there. That's sort of in New Delhi. But young lad getting a Victoria Cross, and there were 30 of those awarded to the Indian Army. But meanwhile, while this was all going on, back at home, while the soldiers went off to fight, as they did in North Africa, in Eritrea, later on in Sicily, rolling into Rome, and then all over Burma and Southeast Asia. Meanwhile, back home, Indians were also adjusting to the war. And some of the photos that I found have been really fascinating because you don't get these accounts in written records. It's really, really different working on the Indian story, say, compared to the British. We'd have nothing like the kind of quality of information that you have in terms of personal stories, diaries, memoirs. You get some for the Indian officers, but you get very little for factory workers, say. Very hard to know what people's experiences were. And some things I only really found about through the photographs, because propaganda photographs were taken showing the sort of work that people were doing in factories, and then I could sort of work backwards from the photographs to try and piece the story together. But it's not as if there's no real sense of museums or archives collecting information. People don't put the same value necessarily on that, those memories, as they would in Britain. So there are, and in propaganda, in the Imperial War Museum and in America, actually, a lot in America, I found in Washington, D.C., there's some wonderful photographs of what was happening in factories, in munitions plants, at the docks, and that sort of thing. But it's hard, it's really hard to get to the kind of nitty-gritty and the voices of those people themselves and what they were doing. This is one. Can you see it properly? Can you see it? Yeah, good. This is the building of the Lado Road. Big road that ran, sometimes called the Stillwell Road, that ran up through from India, through Burma into China. It was meant to be a way to get supplies and soldiers instead of flying across the hump, instead of having to fly across the Himalayas. The idea was there'd be a big road that would do this instead. It's quite a mad scheme, as to be said. And a lot of the people working on that were women, young peasant women, barefooted, digging this road out, particularly in the early days before they got machinery up there. Field Marshal Slim writes in his memories of the war in that defeat into victory, pick, shovel and basket roads made by human labour with almost laughable lack of machinery. And so there were Burmese, Indians, Chinese working on these roads, digging them out. A lot of it was pretty nasty, and I do describe it in the book. Lots of monsoon weather, a lot of disease, very bogged down in mud. About 8 million man days were poured into this road by Indian labourers. But there's at least one account by a British engineer where he can point to a point on the road where 600 of his coolies died. So there's a very unknown contribution by labour in that building of that road. And another building, works that went on, aerodromes being carved out of the landscape, all sorts of building projects going on right across the subcontinent. This one I love, it's Indian women cleaning parts for tanks. And can see the parts in front of them, and they're working there on these tank parts. Again, you just don't see it in the written record. Won't see it. Won't find much information about it. But it's there in the pictures, and you can see it. So actually, there were, just like in Britain, where a lot of women moved into industry and had new work. Same happened in India. Lots of women were drawn to the cities because men were going off into the army. Young men were in demand. And so there were women working and actually able to make wages. In the mines in India, there'd been legislation stopping women working underground before the start of the war. So they couldn't work as miners. War starts, coal's needed, young men away fighting. The women go back into the mines, the legislation's lifted, and the women are able to go back into mining. So they're doing some pretty tough work in support of the war, some of these labourers. But there were also the women, and I was really interested in the women, who were the wives of these soldiers. What did they do when their men went off to fight in Italy or in Burma? And of course, it's the same story as in Europe. Long absences, lack of postal contact, waiting for money and waiting for remittances. And the average Indian soldier would send back, of an 18 rupee wage, 15 rupees. You know, they were sending it all back to the family. And the idea was that one soldier would go and the family benefited from the wage. So if that remittance didn't come, or if they hadn't heard from that soldier for a long time, that was created immense anxiety, not just because they were worried about the soldier, but because they're also worried about the money. And so there are stories that do pop up occasionally with women desperately anxious to know where their men are, but also to know what's happened to them and if their money is coming, because their whole family is depending on it. Nazir Begum, I found her letter to an officer in the National Army Museum. She says that she doesn't have a penny left and she hasn't heard from her husband. Why isn't he writing to her? And I quote, "At the end, I will also request, if he is not willing to provide for my maintenance, he can by all means extricate me from his clutches by a divorce deed." So she sent this to his officer. But for women, this was a really serious thing, because if they were divorced, there'd be no pension. And a lot of the women would actually go back to live with their in-laws whilst their husband was away. And that could be really dodgy. There's a lot of stories about Indian women's relationships with their mothers-in-laws. You know, it's not a great situation to be in, waiting there for your man to return, because they would be seen as a burden, another mouth to feed in some cases. And so these women were often left sort of in limbo, if you like, and waiting. And there are stories of broken marriages, of women desperately waiting over long periods of time, long absences, and of some who never knew what happened to their men. And of mothers who tried to actually hide their children when the recruiting officers came round. In Nepal, we know about the Gurkhas, and we think of the Gurkhas. But actually, on the other side, some of the women were very resistant to those men going into the Gurkhas. One Nepali captain said that about half who he knew had left without parental permission. And there's a quote given to an anthropologist, Mary Ann Cheen, who did really good work with the Gurkhas sort of 20 years back. In her interview, she said, this Nepali woman said, "I heard the whole world was fighting, but why they needed my son's father to settle it, I didn't understand." So some of these women were, left kind of uncertain about what was happening and what would happen to their men. And in the meantime, those in the rural areas, in villages, were actually having to just do more stuff, having to do more hard labour in the fields, having to get up earlier because they had to actually keep all the things going, make up for the lack of manpower. So in terms of harvesting, collecting firewood, and all those sorts of roles, they had more on their plates because the men weren't there. So that's an aspect that I think has not been told. Here we see some women labourers on an aerodrome, and with the baskets on their heads. It's really grisly, and it's sort of outside the scope of this talk, but I have to mention the Bengal famine, because it is really the most major disruption that happened in India because of the war, connected to the war, in 1943. There's a terrible famine in Bengal, which various estimates suggest killed between 1.5 to 3 million people. And the causes of that famine, incredibly complex, can't really sort of summarise it in any sort of nutshell at all. But one of the things that I was interested in was how the soldiers themselves picked up on this. So the letters that exist in censorship files still in London show that soldiers as far away as North Africa were kind of getting letters back saying, look, it's terrible here, there's no food, there's food shortages. What are we going to do? And this awful pull on morale, because in a sort of reverse of what you usually expect, instead of the people back home being worried about the soldiers were worried about the people back home and whether they could eat and what they were eating. And the root cause of the famine, really, a lot of it across India was inflation, and it's war-driven inflation. Prices were just going up and up and up, and they were outstripping pay, even though pay was going up. And particularly for rural labourers, there was just food became extremely expensive. There was hoarding, and there were also shortages. And different historians will argue about what caused that. I'm not going to go into it. But just to say that, you know, this was part of the background noise, part of the thing that's happening, and actually shaping soldiers' experiences too. They're conscious of what's happening whilst that terrible famine is going on. And they write, you know, to their officers saying, their officers are writing on their behalf almost, saying, what's happening? You know, what's going on about the food situation in India? And you also have very moving accounts, and there's some in the book, of British soldiers who are stationed in Calcutta or in Bengal at the time of the famine, who are devastated by what they see on the streets of Calcutta, because, you know, they're just trying to work out what's going on, you know, and they're really upset by that. And a lot of British soldiers who go through India in the 1940s had very mixed feelings about the empire as a result, or were very unsettled, I think it's fair to say, by some of the things that they saw in India that didn't necessarily gel with what they expected to find in the Raj, in what they'd expected to know before they went. So I tried to reflect a little bit on some of those things too in the book. Finally, this is a character, one of the people who features in the book, an individual called Aruna Asaf Ali. And Aruna is just an example, I think, of somebody who gets involved in that activism, anti-war, anti-British activism in India in the 1940s. And I was just interested in her story and why she did and what happened to her. Aruna was about 30 at the start of the war, and her husband was a congressman, so he was a follower of Nehru and Gandhi. But she wasn't particularly active. She wasn't particularly politically active. She was a sort of society hostess. She held sort of nice parties, and she had a kind of salon and a nice house in Delhi that people used to go to. In 1942, when it looks like some sort of rebellion or resistance is going to happen in India, there's a preemptive arrest of the Congress leaders, of Nehru and of Gandhi and of all the kind of key leading Indian National Congress leaders, but also the kind of less well-known ones, lots of them. And so Aruna Asaf Ali's husband was arrested, and he's in prison for the rest of the time. And when this happens and a kind of revolt breaks out, she was kind of catapulted into kind of political activism, if you like. She goes to Bombay, she starts marching, she goes on a protest, and she's involved in a clash where police kill some protesters. There are tear gas being thrown. And there's a kind of charge put out on her head. And she goes underground for the rest of the war. And for the next 3 or 4 years, she's involved in underground radio broadcasting. There's sort of running underground radio. They're doing pretty dangerous and horrible things. You know, they're trying to derail train some of those Quit India protesters. They are trying to cut telegraph wires. They are anti-war in every way, anti-British in so much as they're protesting against the Raj. And their case was, you know, first give us independence and then think about the war. Now, Aruna went underground. She did all this. Big charge was put on her head, but she didn't emerge. Nobody found her. It was only really in 1946, when the arrest warrant was lifted, that she came out of hiding and sort of made her peace with not only the British people that she knew, but also her husband, who'd been, meanwhile, in prison, tearing his hair out, worrying about what she was doing, and actually very concerned that she was using violent means which was against Gandhi's instructions. So the reason I sort of talk about her and I suppose and think about her also in relation to someone like Subhash Chandra Bose is there were these individuals who were doing things absolutely sort of against the war effort at exactly the same time as you have these other individuals who are involved in supporting the war in so much as they're labouring, they're being recruited, they're working as soldiers. And you have both these stories sort of side by side in India at the same time. And for a lot of people, that was very confusing and not very clear at all. And so the ideological commitment, whether people were committed to nationalism or they were committed to anti-fascism, was very unclear when food was short, wages were going up, and also for the leaders themselves, people like Nehru, Jawaharlal Nehru, who became the first Prime Minister of independent India, he's very strongly anti-fascist. He feels very strongly against the Nazis, but he's kind of torn because he feels that he has to support the anti-British cause in the 1940s because the nationalists felt that the first priority was to get freedom for India. And that was the fight that they'd been fighting for 20, 30 years. So I think they made the wrong call. But I think the challenge for historians is to try and tell both those stories side by side and to try and show how complex that was, not just that it's either one thing or the other, that actually lots of ordinary people, millions of ordinary people, were caught up in a war which felt like a very troublesome and difficult time and a very challenging time to be in India. My own story is that I have a white British grandfather who was an officer, emergency commissioned officer, in the Indian Army, and I also had a Pakistani grandfather who was sort of involved in the anti-British side. So for me, it feels like I could see both sides of that coin, and that's why, you know, it's a personal story for me too. But I think also for us in Britain in telling this history, it's not just a story of heroism and of holding up the Indian soldier as a loyal ally. They were that too. They were loyal allies in many ways, but it's also a complex story where there were elements of coercion, there were difficulties, there was food shortage, and many people had a very difficult time in India during the 1940s and couldn't straightforwardly understand necessarily the whole picture of what was happening in Europe. Thank you very much.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Sound the gifting panic alarm. You need to get an amazing gift. Wait, no, the perfect gift. Relax. Now you can use Gift Mode on Etsy. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting, so you can find the perfect item for anyone and any occasion. It's easy. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about who you're shopping for and what they like. And Gift Mode instantly gives you curated gift ideas based on hundreds of personas. Now it's simple to find gifts made by independent sellers for all the people in your life. So whether you need a housewarming gift for the new homeowner or a birthday present for the pickleballer, Gift Mode has you covered. Need to find the perfect gift? Don't panic. Try Gift Mode on Etsy now.